Feeling-driven.
Willpower.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of Willpower Podcast. My name is Ilaria Biancacci, journalist and founder of Willpower, and we are here today with Gail Rego, activist, intersectional feminist, and ethical technologist based in Brussels.
Thank you very much, Gail, to be here with us today and discuss about the role of women in STEM, but not just in science technology, but mostly the way that technology is representing women and the way that women can use technology to their own use and in the proper way. So Gail, I will ask you to just a question. The first question is, you define yourself as an activist and intersectional feminist. How do you combine all these aspects and how they are shaping your career and experience?
First of all, Ilaria, for having me, well, for being interested in my story and asking me to share it, it's truly a privilege. So for your first question, kind of mixing my experiences as an activist, intersectional feminist, and ethical technologist as well. I mean, first I wanted to say that I have been working in the NGO sector for a long time now, about 10 years. However, my interest and kind of more active participation as an activist is a bit more recent. Kind of just, you know, also to acknowledge that not all of us start our understanding of the structural issues when it comes to gender, race. Not everyone starts this at a very early point in their life. And similarly for me, it was more recently, I'm based in Brussels now, and maybe in the last several years, I've been taking more of an active interest in being an activist. And for me, that means things like understanding that I have so much to learn and that I need to be doing that learning actively. So I have been attending webinars, talking to a lot of interesting, inspiring women who have been doing this kind of work in social justice movements for a long time, you know, going to protests, things like that, just feeling not only that I have the understanding, empathy, and knowledge of what it is to be an activist, but also using that, you know, so that I feel a bit more empowered and that I'm lending in whatever way my voice and the privileges I have to kind of further that. So one of the things I think right now, the term intersectional feminist is thrown around a lot. I'm very well aware of that. And I think it is a very complicated kind of thing to explain. What does that actually mean? For me, being an intersectional feminist means acknowledging and deconstructing the various identities that we all have as women. So I am a woman of color. That means I'm a brown woman. I am also a woman. I have been a migrant for most of my life. But it also means things like, you know, acknowledging the privileges I have. I speak English natively. I have had access to education. I have a job in Europe, especially during the pandemic. These are a lot of privileges that I'm aware of. But at the same time, it also means for me, being an intersectional feminist is taking seriously the kind of the needs and the voices of people who I don't see around me. You mentioned earlier that sometimes you look around the room and you see how many other women are, you know, in spaces for journalists. Similarly, I do the same in my day-to-day job working in digital rights or when it comes to activist spaces. I look around and I try to see how many other women and women of color specifically are invited to those spaces. And unfortunately, oftentimes, there are very few. How many Muslim women are invited to these spaces? How many women with disabilities, trans women, are invited to these spaces? Well, usually zero, very, very few. And I'm very aware of this. And I don't have expertise on a lot of these topics. But whenever there is need to kind of bring the idea of how is tech, how is advocacy, how is the communication that we're doing on a day-to-day level possibly affecting, or is it taking into consideration all of these different viewpoints? That's where I really try to make the effort, not only of speaking on other people's behalf, but bringing those voices to the table so that they can talk about their lived experiences. And I think all of these interests, me being curious about how to be an activist, me really wanting to have an intersectional approach, and then more recently getting into digital rights, this has really shaped not only who I am, not only the networks and the experiences that I have now, but also kind of how I can lead these spaces and conversations. Definitely, if I hadn't given more thought to kind of intersectional feminism, the amount of value I would be able to create in a digital space would be very limited, I think. So it definitely has shaped me, and I hope that these experiences will continue to shape any of the personal or professional kind of endeavors that I take.
For someone that maybe is not very used to all this terminology, what is an ethical technologist? What does it do?
Yeah. To me, again, I think an ethical technologist is someone who works with or on technology. So in my case, I'm not someone who creates or develops apps or websites per se. I'm someone who really works within the digital rights sector. And that really means looking at things like, let's even say access to the internet. Does everyone have access to the internet? Or things like these technologies or social media platforms or big tech, as we call them, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google, Amazon, how do they interact and treat content from women or Black people or people with disabilities? So asking those critical questions and also understanding what role technology and the internet and the digital space in general plays on things like structural racism or structural gender roles. And the thing is, I think even for me in this last year with the Black Lives Matter protests, with Me Too a few years ago, we are starting to see how everything is so interconnected, right? Just because you might not be a Black woman doesn't mean that you don't see or experience or hear about the challenges that other Black people are facing, especially because of technology. So the fact that Black Lives Matter moved all the way even to Belgium, for example, where we had a big protest earlier this year, was because of the power of social media. So it's so tricky to kind of see both the positive aspects of how these social movements can grow because of these powerful platforms, but also whose voices are oppressed by the same platforms and why they do that and whose interests is it to show certain content and not the other. In my mind, that is what being an ethical technologist is. It is asking those fundamental questions about, should technology be ethical? And if so, what does ethical mean? Who does it need to be ethical towards? Just a certain group or to all of us? And then how do we actually make that reality happen?
Right. It's very, it is very complicated because what as you said, what we see big movement, you mentioned Me Too, Black Lives Matter, I'm thinking about as well period poverty movement, all of these things, but then at the same times the ads and the information you see on social media, they are not, they it's like they're rowing on the other side. So why is all of this happening? If you don't really pay attention, then the message will just come to you and you will go with the flow without even thinking, wait a second, maybe this is not right, you know. We just using and abusing social media and internet sometimes without even thinking what we are really doing, what we're putting out there, because then it will leave a trace, right?
Absolutely.
You travel a lot, quite a lot. I saw you work in Colombia, Austria, Kenya, and right now you're living in Belgium. And these are the key countries you focus on. What in your opinion and experience, what are the differences between them when it comes to women and digital rights?
So, I mean, I'll start by just saying that these are the countries that I've lived and worked in to different extents. And like I mentioned, my journey into digital rights was a very active decision that I took, but just last year. So this is quite new to me. However, being a woman and being a feminist is something that I can kind of look back on these experiences and tell you about them. So to start with, I was born and raised in Dubai. And I think what's very interesting is that in terms of empowerment, women empowerment, the government, actually the UAE government, invests a lot of that. And there are a lot of very bold, active, strong women. It's just that those women or those resources are mostly only put towards Emirati women, so women who are citizens of the UAE. So it's, you know, this again brings me to kind of intersectionality, right? I am a woman who grew up in Dubai, but because of all of the discrimination and racism in the UAE, I was never given access to these platforms. I have attended so many conferences and events about women empowerment, but it was only about, you know, empowering certain kind of women, women who already had access to power and education and these kinds of resources. Somehow brown women, black women, Filipino women, all of these big groups, migrant groups in Dubai were kind of forgotten. We were not given that space. We were not really acknowledged within the whole women empowerment thing. So this is, I think it's very painful. And it's very sad, but this is really the reality I had growing up in Dubai, which is also one of the reasons why I decided, you know, as an activist and as someone who really values kind of treating people equally and being treated equally, that this really was not my place to be. Then, in terms of Colombia, that was a whole other story. I mean, I kind of went to Colombia because I wanted to go to something that was radically different from the UAE, and Colombia was definitely radically different, and I loved it. It will always be a place that will be really close to my heart, and I hope my Colombian friends will allow me to say that that I am partly Colombian because of my experience there. And again, I'm speaking in general terms, and I don't mean to say that this is the only experience, but what I saw there was very interesting from a gender perspective, is that women get a really raw deal in Colombia. Forgive me for the sweeping generalizations here, but the beauty standards that are expected of women in Colombia are ridiculously high. That's why I saw, you know, so much plastic surgery happening in the country, everything, you know, from nose jobs, boob jobs, ass jobs, because the expectation of what you needed to look like was so unreasonably high. And then, I mean, and that was already quite shocking, you know, kind of a culture shock, because it's not only very common, but it's also very normal. So this is not at all strange that women at a very young age have plastic surgery. Something that bothered me even more is something that I see very much within my own culture in India, which is this priority given to men and men's interests over the needs and difficulties of women. And by that I mean, there are so many young women in Colombia who have become mothers, and who have had to raise their children by themselves, plainly for the reason that men don't want to wear condoms. That's basically it. And so can you imagine having to put yourself in a situation where your partner does not think that it's a big deal for you to give birth to a child, raise that child forever, but it's more bothersome that they don't wear condoms? So this is something that really infuriated me, and it makes me so upset. But this is something that I think you can see in so many cultures, right? I mean, even in Europe, in a different context, but this prioritization of whose needs are more important, this was something that I could starkly see in Colombia. there were many other countries that you mentioned as well. I mean, suffice to say, I mean, for Kenya, I didn't live there long enough to kind of really give you my gender perspective there. It was just really interesting for me to see the different kind of beauty standards again in Africa, in Kenya, compared to what that looks like in the West, you know, the things that are seen as beautiful or not. And there were some things that were very similar to the Western world and some things that were really not. And then kind of to talk about my experience in Belgium, where I've lived the longest now as an adult. So Belgium is a very interesting kettle of fish, because on one hand, the kind of gender norms are more quiet and hidden. The racism is more quiet and hidden, but it's there, you know. It just depends how hard you want to look, right? It's kind of like what I said earlier about looking around the room and seeing how many of these other oppressed groups are represented, right? That gives you a very good idea of how much of this diversity and inclusion thing is just talk versus, you know, people are actually putting things in place to bring these voices on board. So in Belgium, for example, where I live now, on one hand, I have access to so many opportunities, both professionally and personally, even, you know, this interview with you now, I have had so many opportunities that I never would have dreamed would be possible or available to me. And I'm very grateful for that. But at the same time, I'm very accurately aware of when I'm speaking, you know, for example, today it's all about webinars and online meetings because of the pandemic. And I am very consciously looking at who else is in the room. And oftentimes, as I said, the platform is really not given to a lot of these other groups. So I think Brussels and Belgium in general has a long way to go when it comes to not just paying racism and gender kind of a sexism, not just giving it lip service, but really tackling it seriously. And I think one of the core kind of issues there is talking about things like sexism and racism. It's very uncomfortable. Nobody really wants to do it. Even me as an activist, I don't necessarily want to go, you know, and have a chat with, I don't know, friends of my partner or my family and be like, oh, hey, by the way, that joke, that's racist. Nobody wants to be that person. But at the same time, if you aren't brave, if you don't make those small changes within your own, you know, family and friend environments, how will things change? It's definitely not going to change because I tell some random stranger on the street, hey, you know, that joke is racist. So,
yeah. I agree. And how do you think we can make technology more inclusive and diverse? And artificial intelligence as well?
I'm not an expert yet on these topics, though I would very much like to be. But I have some ideas since I've been, you know, like I said, I made a very deliberate decision last year to quit my job. And the reason I did that was because I decided I really wanted to work within the digital rights sector. And this was for various reasons linked to my, you know, the values that I have in terms of creating more inclusive, diverse, just, fair world. So in terms of how to make AI and technology kind of more inclusive, I think there are a couple of things I would suggest. The first is we need to think about, you know, who makes the technology and for whom, right? So as long as you have generally white, cis-abled men behind the table making these apps or these technologies, and most of the ones I mentioned earlier, indeed it is the case. It's generally these very powerful men from Silicon Valley. As long as they're the ones who are making the technology, you can be sure that the incentive of profit is always going to be higher than things like ethics and inclusion. And so I think if feminists, right? I'm not saying if women, I'm saying if feminists, if intersectional feminists, if people who have been harmed and understand how devastating that can be, if they were the people creating technologies, creating apps and solutions, you would have many differences. So for example, and I can't speak for you, Ilaria, but I know that as a woman of color, being online can be a very scary place. You are very careful about what you say. The backlash can be very violent. I know a lot of women who have faced a lot of death and rape threats online. And I think that just goes with being, you know, a woman. And I think a lot of women would just have this understanding and want to bake safety into the apps or the technologies we create. I also think things like, you know, ethics is not just a buzzword. Inclusion is not just a buzzword. How do you really include that? I think these are the kinds of difficult conversations that a lot of women of color have been having for a long time. They were not really listened to. It was not taken seriously until more recently with the Black Lives Matter. But these are, you know, this is work that has been happening for years. And I think if these were the people we asked and paid to be at that table, making these decisions, making these products, creating strategies, we would have much more inclusive and ethical technology. The second thing that I would say in terms of how we can improve it is I'm really annoyed, and I think this is the case with a lot of people who work in digital rights, about this idea of data being unbiased or AI being unbiased. That's just not true. And that's very simply because of the fact of our world is full of bias. You may know what your biases are or you may not, but we all have them, me included. And so if the world is biased and you have, as I said, very select group of people creating these technologies who then use data on the basis of the bias of the world, and they input this all of this data into these algorithms, eventually you have algorithms that use this biased data to create more biased outcomes, not less. But the problem is, instead of recognizing that as just a core flaw, as a structural issue, a lot of people who create these technologies pretend that technology itself can fix these issues. But that's, again, not going to be true. And some examples that I can kind of give of this is AI technology, which I think is very scary, is already being used to predict a bunch of stuff that it is not good at predicting. So things like who could be a future criminal or who could be the best kind of culture fit for your organization in terms of recruitment. Or who from the applicants who have asked for a loan have the highest possibility of paying back these loans or not. These are all decisions that companies, public infrastructure like banks, hospitals, and governments are already using to make key decisions about who gets loans, who gets put in prison, who gets jobs, who gets housing. And people have no idea not only that these technologies are being used, but how biased these technologies are. So it's really terrifying to me that not only do we live in a racist, sexist world, but that we're now relying more heavily on technology that will make the world more racist and sexist. So that's kind of my second thing. Let's not pretend data is unbiased. It isn't. And until you can put in place a lot of testing mechanisms, a lot of accountability structures within your processes, you cannot, you should not sell a product and pretend that it is going to solve any structural issues, because no technology can fix, you know, huge problems like global warming or corona or racism. It's just, that is not something that can be done. I know we would want that. We would like that, but it's just not possible. I don't want to say that technology is bad or that AI cannot create any value. I'm not saying that. I think, you know, for example, I just heard earlier today, the AI that it was able to, I think, win a chess tournament against, you know, a really influential chess player. AI can do things well, but they can do one specific thing, you know. AI is not able to understand context and nuance. It is not able to understand that a person might be black and disabled and Muslim and a woman, and how all of those different oppression and, you know, structural oppression and should be taken into account to create a fair system, because it's a program, it's code, and you can't embed code with nuance. That is why it's even so complicated for human beings to have conversations about a lot of these polarizing topics, and then we expect, you know, algorithms to kind of fix it. It's not realistic, but I hope that people will understand why, right? If you and me cannot sit in a room and break down how we can fix global warming, how do you expect that any kind of technology would be able to do that? Yeah.
You mentioned that AI does good things, of course. It's not just everything bad. I know that you used to work as a head of communication and membership at Missing Children in Europe, and that you use technology and AI to implement campaigns to raise awareness around this topic. How did that work in a positive way?
So I don't know if I can necessarily give you a really beautiful rainbow of a story. What's really interesting about my journey with Missing Children Europe, where I worked for many years, is that very unexpectedly, I happened to start working on more tech-related projects. And that was really a stepping stone for me to understand both the possibilities of technology and the limitations and harms. So, for example, one of the projects that we were working on was a really large project with many different partners. And the goal or the aim was to create an app that would help find missing children. Not going too much into the specifics of the project, and I hope I can link this neatly to what I was saying earlier. When you talk about fixing issues like missing children, right, it sounds beautiful on paper. You're like, oh, an app that fixes this issue, amazing, let's download it, let's use it. But at the end of the day, let's break down the problem a bit more, right? What do I mean when I say missing children? Well, in Europe, over 50% of missing children cases are actually of children who run away or who are thrown out of home. So let's assume you use this app, you find the child, you put them back in the situation that they were, I don't know, maybe abused in, they were bullied in. What do you think is going to happen? The child will run away again, or the child will be in a vulnerable position. And this is what I mean by tech can't solve structural issues. A structural issue of, you know, difficulties in families, bullying in schools, these are things that require way more thought, nuance, processes than just a simple app can fix. But it can help in different ways. So definitely the app that was being created was trying to use a bunch of interesting technology. It was trying to map things and predict things like where could these children possibly go. It was looking at things like, okay, looking at the trajectories of bus routes and train routes and looking at social media, you know, what are the interests of the child. There are really interesting things that technology can do. But let us not be naive to think that it will fix, you know, the underlying issue of what makes our societies and communities function. You know, things like respect, love, good parenting, kindness, all of these things are never going to be something that technology can create, though it could be something that technology helps a little, or that it breaks down and doesn't help. Maybe to kind of give you an example of a really cool project that mm-hmm. we did work on in terms of technology, something that I really love, it's called notfound.org. And the idea is really simple and I think quite genius. Basically, when you go to a website, any website, and if you type in kind of a wrong link or something with a typo, it takes you to a 404 error page. Yeah. And then you really have the message 404 page not found. The idea with the not found app was that websites could download this little app, this little piece of free code, where every time a person reaches a 404 not found page, instead they would see a message that said, uh-oh, 404, page not found, and neither is this child. And then you would have a poster of a missing child, and it allowed way more visibility of these, you know, long-term cold cases, perhaps, of missing children, which, you know, it's difficult to predict how useful it was to find children, but there are other benefits of these things as well, right? Even if it's just allowing parents to feel like someone out there is still looking for their child, someone out there is doing something to help find their child. These technologies may have other kind of, not direct, but indirect positive impacts. And that was really an example of a very simple app that I think I think it was an idea that really caught on. A lot of different countries and wanted to kind of implement and use this technology. And even today, many years since the project was launched, it receives a lot of support. So, yeah.
Somehow it raised awareness around the topic, because maybe it's something that not everyone was aware, and it kept this, the hope alive, as you say, for the family, to make them think, okay, no one is going to be forgotten, you know?
It sounds like you were working with us on the communication campaign. That is really the whole purpose of the app. It really was to keep hope alive and to make people feel, you know, also that they're contributing, right? Like, it's so easy for a website to download this and at least think, okay, I'm using my useless error pages to help someone, to help families, to help children.
I think it's very interesting as well, because in this digital area as well, the flow of information is so quick that a news become old after 3-4 seconds or some, and we tend to forget, you know. Maybe now for 2020, Black Lives Matter has been like a boom, something extraordinary. In a year, there will be something else happening and everyone will forget about the achievement or the struggles, or even thinking about Black Lives Matter, not many people knew, and they still don't know, what was the situation of racism, even here in the UK, I'm talking about 20, 30 years ago, and there was no social media, but the movement was still there, was still big, and it just got lost in tons of information, and we just don't, we tend to forget. So the way to put in an error page the possibility to remember, I think, was a very good practice.
Yeah.
Maybe can be used for many other things. Just to remind how many women get abused every day, or how many women cannot experience their period freely because they cannot afford the tampons, or whatever is the reason. You know, that would be just a very provocative, I think.
Way. Yeah, absolutely. And I think there, you know, what I really like is when you think of creative ways to use technology to solve an issue. I think there is plenty of ways, because, you know, I think NGOs, I mean, working in the NGO sector for so long, you have so many priorities and so little resources that oftentimes you have to be really creative about how you create change. And I think there's a lot of opportunity that tech provides, that you really have to be careful how you do it, you know. So with that bigger project that I was talking about, right, to help find missing children, it's not enough that you're like, oh, let's create a product that solves this issue. You also have to think about things like, how do you keep that data safe? Because you're going to be putting very sensitive information of vulnerable children into into a database, into an app. And we are well aware that a lot of the big giant corporations that have so much data about us cannot be fully safe. They're hacked, they're leaked all the time. So you have to be so conscious about so many different levels. If your app eventually helps find two children but has leaked all of this information to, you know, God knows how many people, imagine the amount of damage you will do. And I think these are also interesting questions that more people working in technology need to think about.
I read your article on how algorithm bias affect you, especially if you're not a white man, and you already went through how the algorithm is affecting minorities and black people when it comes to data and online. Is there anything else you would like to add that we didn't talk about already?
I think what I would do is give a few concrete examples, right? Because sometimes I think a lot of people, they, you know, maybe you've watched the Netflix documentary, you know, and you know a little bit about data, but a lot of these things feel very abstract. A lot of people are like, you know, what's the big deal if these big organizations have all of my data? You know, to which I would say, well, do you really want someone to know who you're talking to, how long you're talking to them, what your sexual preferences are, what your political preferences are, and then sell that data to advertisers who will then create a perfect little package for you to manipulate you, to change your mind, to make you vote for something, to make you buy something. I think most people would not want that. But okay, so that's one question. But I wanted to give some examples that I've also shared in this article that I wrote about how algorithm bias affects you specifically. And I was talking mostly about recruitment. So I'd like to give some examples there of how this kind of works. So there are some really famous cases, and so maybe some of the listeners know some of these. But for example, for a significant period of time, researchers realized that when people were looking for jobs on Google search, for example, women were being served with ads that were different to men. And the ads that they were being served were generally of jobs that were not as senior and not as well paid as the results that were being served to men. And this kind of shows this very tricky loop of algorithmic bias, right? For example, I don't think someone at Google was like, oh, let's make sure that women see only lower paid jobs. I think what probably happened is they fed a bunch of data into the algorithm, and the data was like, oh, who generally happen to be senior managers and who happen generally to be middle managers and entry-level people? And on that basis, they were like, okay, it seems that more white men are in this position. Let's make sure we give more white men access to this. And it perpetuates this cycle. This is what we were talking about a little bit earlier. So this is one shocking example of how even Google search results were showing very different things and furthering gender bias in the recruitment process. Another example I give is, you know, very simple things like, you have to be careful about the words you use, the symbols you use, or the images you use in your communication on your social media, on your websites, because all of this has an impact on who's applying for jobs, right? So there was some research that showed that if you use masculine words, so think, I don't know, like let's say things like guru, or I've seen this a lot, there's an ad for, you know, a job vacancy, and the picture is of two white men shaking hands. Well, you know, you need to think about that. How many, you know, women of color, how many disabled people do you think are going to be applying to those jobs when they see that kind of imagery or those words, right? So, I mean, this research is basically saying that women who perceive these kinds of masculine ads or words in ads were generally less likely to apply for jobs. So already, before women had even applied for a job, there was already, you know, this mechanism in place that was going to have less diverse applications in the hiring process. And then another example that I quite that I think is very important, you know, when it comes to race, I mentioned earlier that already a lot of this technology is being sold at very high prices to governments and companies saying, hey, this product is going to make sure that your recruitment has no bias, which is not true. But so one example of kind of how AI is being used for recruitment is through the use of facial recognition. So let's say you have a, you know, interview process, and in the first interview, in fact, you're only going to be interviewed by an AI system, or you submit your CV and it's being looked at by an AI system. And what they found is that a lot of facial recognition technology that has been developed is much better at recognizing white male faces compared to white female faces, and much, much, much worse at being able to distinguish black faces, right? And so can you start to imagine then what are the consequences of that? So, I mean, it's one thing, so for example, if a facial recognition technology is being used to understand things like, you know, emotions, is this person being honest in this interview, things like that. If the technology cannot even differentiate well between black faces, that is going to have a big impact on what it kind of informs these hiring managers. You know, another really scary example of how this technology is being used is there were many high-profile examples in the US, at least, of how black men, several black men, were repeatedly put in prison for crimes they did not commit because the police officers or the police, the law enforcement, were using facial recognition technologies that could not distinguish between black men's faces. And so that just that a lot of innocent black men were being put in prison. So, and it again, you know, it's you feed information to something, you're not careful about how diverse that information is, you're not asking questions about, you know, how is this information collected, by whom, who's creating it, and it just furthers a lot of this very damaging outcomes. And this is what's scary about it, right? I mean, things like having equal access to jobs is very important, but so is having equal access to healthcare. And a lot of hospitals, schools, airports, you know, are already using a lot of different kinds of AI that has not been tested, that has not been checked if they're ethical. So I find this very worrying. And so these are some of the things that I was talking about in my article about how algorithmic bias affects all of us, but especially if you're not a white man.
Thank you very much for these examples. I think it's going to be a little bit easier for who is listening to understand and also to relate, because I mean, I can say, for example, for recruitment, sometimes I give up on job application because I find that the ads, it's really for a man, the way it's written. And it's not just me, many of other friends of mine, they face the same, especially even in the requirements they will add, I don't know, frequent travel or willing to relocate and stuff like that. They are very sneaky. But they are on a male perspective, because we just assuming that a man will move around, travel, and leave the family back home more easily than a woman. So if you are a woman, and you are family oriented, you already have a family, you have a partner, you'll be like, I don't know if this job is really for me. I mean, the way it's formulated, it just puts you off immediately. So it's really, interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I see examples like that all the time. I mean, I work in communications, so it's so crucial to be cautious of that. And I think, you know, one small example I can think of is previously at an organization I worked at, we were working with an excellent communication officer, and she happened to be queer, and she just included like the queer flag in our Twitter profile, you know. And I think It's simple things like that, but you wouldn't think of it unless you were queer, or, you know, if you were actively working with queer groups. And I think that just helped more people see the organization as queer friendly. And so that probably helped us get more applications from queer people. And I think you'll see a lot more now in applications at the bottom of a vacancy, they'll say, we do not discriminate on the basis of this, which is good. But I think the next important step is to name who exactly you want, you know, to apply for these jobs. Don't be embarrassed to say, we encourage, we promote, you know, getting applications from oppressed groups like A, B, C, D. Because, I mean, just imagine if you see yourself or something that you can kind of visualize as yourself in a job app, you are going to be more motivated to apply for it. You're going to hope that they have safe spaces or safer spaces in their organizations that will treat you well, because they have asked openly, you know, for that they value diversity and things like that. So I think there's so much that can be done, and I'm really glad that people are talking about it more, but that we have to be very careful, not just, I mean, with technology or without, but the question is, I mean, you know, what I was saying earlier about internet access, I think there is an assumption, even by governments, that everyone has access to the internet. Or for example, with the pandemic, right? Like where there was an assumption that every kid had access to internet, access to a computer, to an iPad. I mean, what if you have three kids at home? Even if you had access to an iPad, right? I mean, that's going to make it very, very difficult. And questions of access, it's a very fundamental, basic place to start from. You cannot expect everyone to have the same socioeconomic standards to be able to provide these things to their kids, right?
COVID really exasperated this difference. They were already there, but with COVID they became even more visible. Even here in the UK, there are so many studies came out of how many kids has been left out from the beginning of the pandemic. For the reason that you say, there is only one computer in the household, and maybe the mother or the father needs that computer because they're working from home, because now every company provides you with a laptop you can work from, or they don't tell you that they don't have a fast internet, so for them to follow lesson on Zoom is really complicated. So it's if we keep going at this pace, but without making sure that we're giving the access to everyone in the same way, because whether we like it or not, it's 2020, so access to internet is a basic right for everyone. Then we're not gonna progress with the correct pace for everyone, unfortunately, and there will be so many left out.
Exactly. And this is this is the thing as well that worries me. I mean, it's one thing talking about how the technologies we use harm us, but let's not forget about people who, you know, I mean, even if you're talking about elderly generations, right, people who are not as digitally tech savvy, if you start moving everything from taxation to banking to buying food online, and you forget to offer options that also take into account the needs of people with disabilities or elderly generations, etc., you are going to create way more disparity and difference between the groups that are technologically savvy and those that are not, and that further creates more economic division.
Yeah, division. Yeah, it's right.
Yeah,
it's right. Is there any advice, any things you would like to share with the WEMPOWER audience and followers that we haven't already mentioned, or anything special?
Well, you shouldn't encourage me to talk too much, Ilaria, because I can talk until for hours, and your poor listeners will think, oh my God, when is she going to stop? But actually, one thing I maybe want to end with, this is a kind of a personal pet peeve a bit, you know, now that intersectional feminism and diversity and inclusion are such sexy words. I mean, this has pros and cons, of course. I'm very glad that people are talking about it more. But just because you say you want more Black applicants doesn't mean you have processes in place or a team in place who will accept and not be racist towards Black applicants, right? But this pet peeve of mine that I wanted to mention is, let us be very careful that when people say we have a diverse team or that we want diversity, that we don't just think of diversity in terms of men and women. There are many spaces where you may have 50-50, in terms of gender, but just because you have white women at the table doesn't mean that you are an intersectional organization or that you're looking at all of the many different aspects of diversity and inclusion, right? I find this a lot. Like, you'll have conferences and events with panels, and moderator will say, oh, it's amazing to see how diverse the panel is, just because you have a group of white men and women. And that really bothers me. It makes me feel that me as a brown woman and other people similar to me are invisible. You know, when people say that. So my advice would be, I think it's very important that we have allies, and you don't need to be Black or disabled to understand why why the systems in place are unfair. If you don't know about these topics, talk to people. Don't be embarrassed to ask questions, as long as it's coming from a place of love and compassion and empathy. And to be very careful, if you have privilege and power, to use that platform to bring more women of color, more Muslim women. Think actively about the groups of women who are usually silenced, who are usually forgotten, and make sure that you create spaces where they feel welcome. I would say this would be my big advice, kind of, to think about.
Thank you very much. Very, very inspiring. Thank you. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Ilaria, for having me.
You can discover more inspiring and powerful stories at www.wempower.co. Buy a membership to support our journalism and follow us on social media at Wempower UK. Don't forget that together we empower women. My name is Ilaria Biancacci for Wempower Podcast. Until next time.